Flowers for Algernon, Disc 5.
June 13. I'm dictating this under great emotional strain. I've walked out on the whole thing. I'm on a plane headed back to New York alone, and I have no idea what I'm going to do when I get there. At first, I admit, I was in awe at the picture of an international convention of scientists and scholars gathered for an exchange of ideas. Here, I thought, was where it all really happened. Here it would be different from the sterile college discussions, because these were the men on the highest levels of psychological research and education, the scientists who wrote the books and delivered the lectures, the authorities people quoted. If Niemer and Strauss were ordinary men working beyond their abilities, I felt sure it would be different with the others. When it was time for the meeting, Niemer steered us through the gigantic lobby with its heavy Baroque furnishings and huge curving marble staircases, and we moved through the thickening knots of handshakers, nodders, and smilers. Two other professors from Beekman, who had arrived in Chicago just this morning, joined us. Professors White and Klinger walked a little to the right and a step or two behind Niemer and Strauss, while Bert and I brought up the rear. Standees parted to make a path for us into the grand ballroom, and Niemer waved to the reporters and photographers, who had come to hear at first hand about the startling things that had been done with a retardate adult in just a little over 3 months. Niemer had obviously sent out advance publicity releases. Some of the psychological papers delivered at the meeting were impressive. A group from Alaska showed how stimulation of various portions of the brain caused a significant development in learning ability, and a group from New Zealand had mapped out those portions of the brain that controlled perception and retention of stimuli. But there were other kinds of papers, too. P.T. Zellerman's study on the difference in the length of time it took white rats to learn a maze when the corners were curved rather than angular, or Warfel's paper on the effect of intelligence level on the reaction time of rhesus monkeys. Papers like these made me angry. Money, time, and energy squandered on the detailed analysis of the trivial. Bert was right when he praised Niemer and Strauss for devoting themselves to something important and uncertain, rather than to something insignificant and safe. If only Niemer would look at me as a human being. After the chairman announced the presentation from Beekman University, we took our seats on the platform behind the long table, Algernon in his cage between Bert and me. We were the main attraction of the evening, and when we were settled, the chairman began his introduction. I half expected to hear him boom out, "Ladies and gentlemen, step right this way and see the sideshow, an act never before seen in the scientific world. A mouse and a moron turned into geniuses before your very eyes." I admit I had come here with a chip on my shoulder. All he said was, "The next presentation really needs no introduction. We've all heard about the startling work being done at Beekman University, sponsored by the Wellberg Foundation grants, under the direction of the chairman of the psychology department, Professor Niemer, in cooperation with Dr. Strauss of the Beekman Neuropsychiatric Center. Needless to say, this is a report we've all been looking forward to with great interest. I turn the meeting over to Professor Niemer and Dr. Strauss." Niemer nodded graciously at the chairman's introductory praise and winked at Strauss in the triumph of the moment. The first speaker from Beekman was Professor Klinger. I was becoming irritated, and I could see that Algernon, upset by the smoke, the buzzing, the unaccustomed surroundings, was moving around in his cage nervously. I had the strangest compulsion to open his cage and let him out. It was an absurd thought, more of an itch than a thought, and I tried to ignore it. But as I listened to Professor Klinger's stereotyped paper on the effects of left-handed goal boxes in a team maze versus right-handed goal boxes in a team maze, I found myself toying with the release lock mechanism of Algernon's cage. In a short while, before Strauss and Niemer would unveil their crowning achievement, Bert would read a paper describing the procedures and results of administering intelligence and learning tests he had devised for Algernon. This would be followed by a demonstration, as Algernon was put through his paces of solving a problem in order to get his meal, something I have never stopped resenting. Not that I had anything against Bert. He had always been straightforward with me, more so than most of the others. But when he described the white mouse who had been given intelligence, he was as pompous and artificial as the others, as if he were trying on the mantle of his teachers. I restrained myself at that point, more out of friendship for Bert than anything else. Letting Algernon out of his cage would throw the meeting into chaos, and after all, this was Bert's debut into the rat race of academic preferment. I had my finger on the cage door release, and as Algernon watched the movement of my hand with his pink candy eyes, I'm certain he knew what I had in mind. At that moment, Bert took the cage for his demonstration. He explained the complexity of the shifting lock and the problem-solving required each time the lock was to be opened. Thin plastic bolts fell into place in varying patterns and had to be controlled by the mouse, who depressed a series of levers in the same order. As Algernon's intelligence increased, his problem-solving speed increased. That much was obvious. But then Bert revealed one thing I had not known. At the peak of his intelligence, Algernon's performance had become variable. There were times, according to Bert's report, when Algernon refused to work at all, even when apparently hungry, and other times when he would solve the problem, but instead of taking his food reward, would hurl himself against the walls of his cage. When someone from the audience asked Bert if he was suggesting that this erratic behavior was directly caused by increased intelligence, Bert ducked the question. "As far as I'm concerned," he said, "there's not enough evidence to warrant that conclusion. There are other possibilities. It is possible that both the increased intelligence and the erratic behavior at this level were created by the original surgery, instead of one being a function of the other. It's also possible that this erratic behavior is unique to Algernon. We didn't find it in any of the other mice, but then none of the others achieved as high a level of intelligence nor maintained it for as long as Algernon has." I realized immediately that this information had been withheld from me. I suspected the reason, and I was annoyed, but that was nothing to the anger I felt when they brought out the films. I had never known that my early performances and tests in the laboratory were filmed. There I was, at the table beside Bert, confused and open-mouthed as I tried to run the maze with the electric stylus. Each time I received a shock, my expression changed to an absurd, wide-eyed stare, and then that foolish smile again. Each time it happened, the audience roared. Race after race, it was repeated, and each time they found it funnier than before. I told myself they were not gawking curiosity seekers, but scientists here in search of knowledge. They couldn't help finding these pictures funny, but still, as Bert caught the spirit and made amusing comments on the films, I was overcome with a sense of mischief. It would be even funnier to see Algernon escape from his cage, and to see all these people scattering and crawling around on their hands and knees, trying to retrieve a small, white, scurrying genius. But I controlled myself, and by the time Strauss took the podium, the impulse had passed. Strauss dealt largely with the theory and techniques of neurosurgery, describing in detail how pioneer studies on the mapping of hormone control centers enabled him to isolate and stimulate these centers, while at the same time removing the hormone inhibitor-producing portion of the cortex. He explained the enzyme block theory and went on to describe my physical condition before and after surgery. Photographs, I didn't know they had been taken, were passed around and commented on, and I could see by the nods and smiles that most people there agreed with him, that the dull, vacuous facial expression had been transformed into an alert, intelligent appearance. He also discussed in detail the pertinent aspects of our therapy sessions, especially my changing attitudes toward free association on the couch. I had come there as part of a scientific presentation, and I had expected to be put on exhibition. But everyone kept talking about me as if I were some kind of newly created thing they were presenting to the scientific world. No one in this room considered me an individual, a human being. The constant juxtaposition of Algernon and Charlie and Charlie and Algernon made it clear that they thought of both of us as a couple of experimental animals who had no existence outside the laboratory. But aside from my anger, I couldn't get it out of my mind that something was wrong. Finally, it was Niemer's turn to speak, to sum it all up as the head of the project, to take the spotlight as the author of a brilliant experiment. This was the day he had been waiting for. He was impressive as he stood up there on the platform, and as he spoke, I found myself nodding with him, agreeing with things I knew to be true. The testing, the experiment, the surgery, and my subsequent mental development were described at length, and his talk was enlivened by quotations from my progress reports. More than once I found myself hearing something personal or foolish read to this audience. Thank God I had been careful to keep most of the details about Alice and myself in my private file. Then, at one point in his summary, he said it. "We who have worked on this project at Beekman University have the satisfaction of knowing we have taken one of nature's mistakes and by our new techniques created a superior human being. When Charlie came to us, he was outside of society, alone in a great city, without friends or relatives to care about him, without the mental equipment to live a normal life. No past, no contact with the present, no hope for the future. It might be said that Charlie Gordon did not really exist before this experiment." I don't know why I resented it so intensely to have them think of me as something newly minted in their private treasury, but it was, I am certain, echoes of that idea that had been sounding in the chambers of my mind from the time we had arrived in Chicago. I wanted to get up and show everyone what a fool he was, to shout at him, "I'm a human being, a person with parents and memories and a history, and I was before you ever wheeled me into that operating room." At the same time, deep in the heat of my anger, there was forged an overwhelming insight into the thing that had disturbed me when Strauss spoke, and again when Niemer amplified his data. They had made a mistake. Of course. The statistical evaluation of the waiting period necessary to prove the permanence of the change had been based on earlier experiments in the field of mental development and learning, on waiting periods with normally dull or normally intelligent animals. But it was obvious that the waiting period would have to be extended in those cases where an animal's intelligence had been increased 2 or 3 times. Niemer's conclusions had been premature. For both Algernon and myself, it would take more time to see if this change would stick. The professors had made a mistake, and no one else had caught it. I wanted to jump up and tell them, but I couldn't move. Like Algernon, I found myself behind the mesh of the cage they had built around me. Now there would be a question period, and before I would be allowed to have my dinner, I would be required to perform before this distinguished gathering. No, I had to get out of there. In one sense, he was the result of modern psychological experimentation. In place of a feeble-minded shell, a burden on the society that must fear his irresponsible behavior, we have a man of dignity and sensitivity, ready to take his place as a contributing member of society. I should like you all to hear a few words from Charlie Gordon. God damn him. He didn't know what he was talking about. At that point, the compulsion overwhelmed me. I watched in fascination as my hand moved, independent of my will, to pull down the latch of Algernon's cage. As I opened it, he looked up at me and paused. Then he turned, darted out of his cage, and scampered across the long table. At first, he was lost against the damask tablecloth, a blur of white on white, until a woman at the table screamed, knocking her chair backwards as she leaped to her feet. Beyond her, pitchers of water overturned, and then Bert shouted, "Algernon's loose!" Algernon jumped down from the table onto the platform and then to the floor. "Get him! Get him!" Niemer screeched as the audience, divided in its aims, became a tangle of arms and legs. Some of the women, non-experimentalists, tried to stand on the unstable folding chairs while others, trying to help corner Algernon, knocked them over.
"Close those back doors!"
shouted Bert, who realized Algernon was smart enough to head in that direction.
"Run!"
I heard myself shout.
"The side door!"
"He's gone out the side door,"
someone echoed.
"Get him, get him,"
begged Niemer. The crowd surged out of the grand ballroom into the corridor as Algernon, scampering along the maroon-carpeted hallway, led them a merry chase. Under Louis XIV's tables, around potted palms, up stairways, around corners, down stairways, into the main lobby, picking up other people as we went. Seeing them all running back and forth in the lobby, chasing a white mouse smarter than many of them, was the funniest thing that had happened in a long time.
"Go ahead, laugh," snorted Niemer, who nearly bumped into me. "But if we don't find him, the whole experiment is in danger."
I pretended to be looking for Algernon under a wastebasket.
"Do you know something?" I said. "You've made a mistake. And after today, maybe it just won't matter at all."
Seconds later, half a dozen women came screaming out of the powder room, skirts clutched frantically around their legs.
"He's in there!"
someone yelled. But for a moment, the searching crowd was stayed by the handwriting on the wall. "Ladies." I was the first to cross the invisible barrier and enter the sacred gates. Algernon was perched on top of one of the wash basins, glaring at his reflection in the mirror.
"Come on," I said. "We'll get out of here together."
He let me pick him up and put him into my jacket pocket.
"Stay in there quietly until I tell you."
The others came bursting through the swinging doors, looking guiltily as if they expected to see screaming nude females. I walked out as they searched the washroom, and I heard Bert's voice.
"There's a hole in that ventilator. Maybe he went up there."
"Find out where it leads to," said Strauss.
"You go up to the second floor," said Niemer, waving to Strauss. "I'll go down to the basement."
At this point, they burst out of the ladies' room, and the forces split. I followed behind the Strauss contingent up to the second floor as they tried to discover where the ventilator led to. When Strauss and White and their half-dozen followers turned right down Corridor B, I turned left up Corridor C and took the elevator to my room. I closed the door behind me and patted my pocket. A pink snout and white fuzz poked out and looked around.
"I'll just get my things packed," I said,
"and we'll take off. Just you and me. A couple of man-made geniuses on the run." I had the bellhop put the bags and the tape recorder into a waiting taxi, paid my hotel bill, and walked out the revolving door with the object of the search nestling in my jacket pocket. I used my return flight ticket to New York. Instead of going back to my place, I planned to stay at a hotel here in the city for one or two nights. We'll use that as a base of operations while I look for a furnished apartment somewhere midtown. I want to be near Times Square. Talking all this out makes me feel a lot better, even a little silly. I don't really know why I got so upset or what I'm doing on a jet heading back to New York with Algernon in a shoebox under the seat. I mustn't panic. The mistake doesn't necessarily mean anything serious. It's just that things are not as definite as Niemer believed. But where do I go from here? First, I've got to see my parents as soon as I can. I may not have all the time I thought I had. Progress Report 14, June 15th. Our escape hit the papers yesterday, and the tabloids had a field day. On the second page of the Daily Press, there was an old picture of me and a sketch of a white mouse. The headline read, "Moron Genius and Mouse Go Berserk." Niemer and Strauss are reported as saying I had been under tremendous strain and that I would undoubtedly return soon. They offered a $500 reward for Algernon, not realizing we were together. When I turned to the later story on the fifth page, I was stunned to find a picture of my mother and sister. Some reporter had obviously done his legwork. Sister unaware of moron genius's whereabouts. Special to the Daily Press. Brooklyn, New York, June 14th. Miss Norma Gordon, who lives with her mother, Rose Gordon, at 4136 Marks Street, Brooklyn, New York, denied any knowledge of her brother's whereabouts. Miss Gordon said, "We haven't seen him or heard from him in more than 17 years." Miss Gordon says she believed her brother dead until last March, when the head of the psychology department at Beekman University approached her for permission to use Charlie in an experiment. "My mother told me he had been sent to the Warren place," Warren State Home and Training School in Warren, Long Island, said Miss Gordon, "and that he died there a few years later. I had no idea that he was still alive." Miss Gordon requests that anyone who has any news about her brother's whereabouts communicate with the family at their home address. The father, Matthew Gordon, who is not living with his wife and daughter, now operates a barber shop in the Bronx. I stared at the news story for a while, and then I turned back and looked at the picture again. How can I describe them? I can't say I remember Rose's face. Although the recent photograph is a clear one, I still see it through the gauze of childhood. I knew her, and I didn't know her. Had we passed on the street, I would not have recognized her, but now, knowing she is my mother, I can make out the faint details, yes. Thin, drawn into exaggerated lines, sharp nose and chin, I can almost hear her chatter and bird screech. Hair done up in a bun, severely, piercing me with her dark eyes. I want her to take me into her arms and tell me I am a good boy, and at the same time, I want to turn away to avoid a slap. Her picture makes me tremble. And Norma, thin-faced too, features not so sharp, pretty, but very much like my mother. Her hair, worn down to her shoulders, softens her. The two of them are sitting on the living room couch. It was Rose's face that brought back the frightening memories. She was two people to me, and I never had any way of knowing which she would be. Perhaps she would reveal it to others by a gesture of hand, a raised eyebrow, a frown. My sister knew the storm warnings, and she would always be out of range whenever my mother's temper flared, but it always caught me unawares. I would come to her for comforting, and her anger would break over me. And other times there would be tenderness and holding close like a warm bath, and hands stroking my hair and brow, and the words carved above the cathedral of my childhood. "He's like all the other children. He's a good boy." I see back through the dissolving photograph myself and father leaning over a bassinet. He's holding me by the hand and saying, "There she is. You mustn't touch her because she's very little, but when she gets bigger, you'll have a sister to play with." I see my mother in the huge bed nearby, bleached and pasty, arms limp on the orchid-figured comforter, raising her head anxiously. "Watch him, Matt!" That was before she had changed towards me, and now I realize it was because she had no way of knowing yet if Norma would be like me or not. It was later on, when she was sure her prayers had been answered and Norma showed all signs of normal intelligence, that my mother's voice began to sound different. Not only her voice, but her touch, her look, her very presence, all changed. It was as if her magnetic poles had reversed, and where they had once attracted, now repelled. I see now that when Norma flowered in our garden, I became a weed, allowed to exist only where I would not be seen, in corners and dark places. Seeing her face in the newspaper, I suddenly hated her. It would have been better if she had ignored the doctors and teachers and others who were so in a hurry to convince her that I was a moron, turning her away from me so that she gave me less love when I needed more. What good would it do to see her now? What could she tell me about myself? And yet I'm curious. How would she react? To see her and trace back to learn what I was, or to forget her? Is the past worth knowing? Why is it so important for me to say to her, "Mom, look at me. I'm not retarded anymore. I'm normal, better than normal. I'm a genius." Even as I try to get her out of my mind, the memories seep back from the past to contaminate the here and now. Another memory when I was much older. A quarrel. Charlie lying in bed with the covers pulled up around him. The room dark except for the thin line of yellow light from the door ajar that penetrates the darkness to join both worlds. And he hears things, not understanding, but feeling, because the rasp of their voices is linked to their talk of him. More and more, each day, he comes to associate that tone with a frown when they speak of him. He has been almost asleep when through the bar of light the soft voices were raised to the pitch of argument, his mother's voice sharp with the threat of one used to having her way through hysteria. "He's got to be sent away. I don't want him in the house anymore with her. Call Dr. Portman and tell him we want to send Charlie to the Warren State Home." My father's voice is firm, steadying. "But you know Charlie wouldn't harm her. It can't make any difference to her at this age." "How do we know? Maybe it has a bad effect on a child to grow up with someone like him in the house." Dr. Portman said... Portman said, I don't care what he said. Think of what it will be like for her to have a brother like that. I was wrong all these years trying to believe he'd grow up like other children. I admit it now, better for him to be put away.
Now that you've got her, you've decided you don't want him anymore.
Do you think this is easy? Why are you making it harder for me? All these years, everyone telling me he should be put away, well, they were right, put him away. Maybe at the home with his own kind, he'll have something. I don't know what's right or wrong anymore. All I know is I'm not going to sacrifice my daughter for him now.
And though Charlie has not understood what passed between them, he's afraid and sinks beneath the covers, eyes open, trying to pierce the darkness that surrounds him. As I see him now, he's not really afraid, just withdrawing, as a bird or squirrel backs off from the brusque movements of the feeder, involuntary, instinctive. The light through that door ajar comes to me again in luminous vision. Seeing Charlie huddled beneath the covers, I wish I could give him comfort, explain to him that he has done nothing wrong, that it is beyond him to change his mother's attitude back to what it was before his sister came. There on the bed, Charlie did not understand what they were saying, but now it hurts. If I could reach out into the past of my memories, I would make her see how much she was hurting me. This is no time to go to her. Not until I've had time to work it out for myself. Fortunately, as a precaution, I withdrew my savings from the bank as soon as I arrived in New York. $886 won't last long, but it will give me time to get my bearings. I've checked into the Camden Hotel on 41st Street, a block from Times Square. New York. All the things I've read about it. Gotham, the melting pot, Baghdad on the Hudson, city of light and color. Incredible that I've lived and worked all my life just a few stops away on the subway and been to Times Square only once. With Alice. It's hard to keep from calling her. I've started and stopped myself several times. I've got to keep away from her. So many confusing thoughts to get down. I tell myself that as long as I keep taping my progress reports, nothing will be lost. The record will be complete.
Let them be in the dark for a while. I was in the dark for more than 30 years. But I'm tired now. Didn't get to sleep on the plane yesterday, and I can't keep my eyes open. I'll pick up at this point tomorrow.
June 16th. Called Alice, but hung up before she answered. Today I found a furnished apartment. $95 a month is more than I planned to spend, but it's on 43rd and 10th Avenue, and I can get to the library in 10 minutes to keep up with my reading and study. The apartment is on the 4th floor, 4 rooms, and there's a rented piano in it. The landlady says that one of these days the rental service will pull it out, but maybe by that time I can learn to play it. Algernon is a pleasant companion. At mealtimes he takes his place at the small gate-leg table. He likes pretzels, and today he took a sip of beer while we watched the ball game on TV. I think he rooted for the Yankees. I'm going to move most of the furniture out of the second bedroom and use the room for Algernon. I plan to build him a 3-dimensional maze out of scrap plastic that I can pick up cheaply downtown. There are some complex maze variations I'd like him to learn to be sure he keeps in shape. But I'm going to see if I can find some motivation other than food. There must be other rewards that will induce him to solve problems. Solitude gives me a chance to read and think, and now that the memories are coming through again, to rediscover my past, to find out who and what I really am. If anything should go wrong, I'll have at least that. June 19th. Met Fay Lilman, my neighbor across the hall. When I came back with an armful of groceries, I discovered I had locked myself out, and I remembered that the front fire escape connected my living room window and the apartment directly across the hall. The radio was on, loud and brassy, so I knocked, softly at first, and then louder.
"Come on in, door's open!"
I pushed the door and froze, because standing in front of an easel, painting, was a slender blonde in pink bra and panties. "Sorry," I gasped, closing the door again. From outside, I shouted, "I'm your neighbor across the hall. I locked myself out and I wanted to use the fire escape to get over to my window." The door swung open and she faced me, still in her underwear, a brush in each hand and hands on her hips.
"Didn't you hear me say come in?"
She waved me into the apartment, pushing away a carton full of trash.
"Just step over that pile of junk there."
I thought she must have forgotten or not realized she was undressed, and I didn't know which way to look. I kept my eyes averted, looking at the walls, ceiling, everywhere but at her. The place was a shambles. There were dozens of little folding snack tables, all covered with twisted tubes of paint, most of them crusted dry like shriveled snakes, but some of them alive and oozing ribbons of color. Tubes, brushes, cans, rags, and parts of frames and canvas were strewn everywhere. The place was thick with the odor compounded of paint, linseed oil, and turpentine, and after a few moments the subtle aroma of stale beer. 3 overstuffed chairs and a mangy green couch were piled high with discarded clothing, and on the floor lay shoes, stockings, and underthings, as if she were in the habit of undressing as she walked and flinging her clothes as she went. A fine layer of dust covered everything.
"Well, you're Mr. Gordon," she said, looking me over. "I've been dying to get a peek at you ever since you moved in. Have a seat."
She scooped up a pile of clothing from one of the chairs and dumped it onto the crowded sofa.
"So you finally decided to visit your neighbors, get you a drink?"
"You're a painter," I burbled for want of something to say. I was unnerved by the thought that any moment she would realize she was undressed and would scream and dash for the bedroom. I tried to keep my eyes moving, looking everywhere but at her.
"Beer or ale?
Nothing else in the place right now except cooking sherry. You don't want cooking sherry, do you?" "I can't stay," I said, getting hold of myself and fixing my gaze at the beauty mark on the left side of her chin. "I've locked myself out of my apartment. I wanted to go across the fire escape. It connects our windows."
"Anytime,"
she assured me.
Those lousy patent locks are a pain in the ass. I locked myself out of this place 3 times the first week I lived here, and once I was out in the hall stark naked for 30 minutes. Stepped out to get the milk and the goddamn door swung shut behind me. I ripped the goddamn lock off and haven't had one on my door since.
I must have frowned because she laughed.
Well, you see what the damned locks do. They lock you out and they don't protect much, do they? 15 burglaries in this goddamn building in the past year, and every one of them in apartments that were locked. No one's ever broke in here, even though the door was always open. They'd have a rotten time finding anything valuable here anyway.
When she insisted again on my having a beer with her, I accepted. While she was getting it from the kitchen, I looked around the room again. What I hadn't noticed before was that the part of the wall behind me had been cleared away, all the furniture pushed to one side of the room or the center, so that the far wall, the plaster of which had been torn off to expose the brick, served as an art gallery. Paintings were crowded to the ceiling, and others were stacked against each other on the floor. Several of them were self-portraits, including 2 nudes. The painting she had been working on when I came in, the one on the easel, was a half-length nude of herself, showing her hair long, not the way she wore it now, up in blonde braids coiled around her head like a crown, down to her shoulders, with part of her long tresses twisted around the front and resting between her breasts. She had painted her breasts up-tilted and firm, with the nipples an unrealistic lollipop red. When I heard her coming back with the beer, I spun away from the easel quickly, stumbled over some books, and pretended to be interested in a small autumn landscape on the wall. I was relieved to see that she had slipped into a thin, ragged housecoat, even though it had holes in all the wrong places, and I could look directly at her for the first time. Not exactly beautiful, but her blue eyes and pert, snub nose gave her a cat-like quality that contrasted with her robust, athletic movements. She was about 35, slender and well-proportioned. She set the beers on the hardwood floor, curled up beside them in front of the sofa, and motioned for me to do the same. "I find the floor more comfortable than chairs," she said, sipping the beer from the can. "Don't you?" I told her I hadn't thought about it, and she laughed and said I had an honest face. She was in the mood to talk about herself. She avoided Greenwich Village, she said, because there, instead of painting, she would be spending all her time in bars and coffee shops. "It's better up here, away from the phonies and the dilettantes. Here I can do what I want, and no one comes to sneer. You're not a sneerer, are you?" I shrugged, trying not to notice the gritty dust all over my trousers and my hands. "I guess we all sneer at something. You're sneering at the phonies and dilettantes, aren't you?" After a while, I said I'd better be getting over to my own apartment. She pushed a pile of books away from the window, and I climbed over newspapers and paper bags filled with empty quart beer bottles. "One of these days," she sighed, "I've got to cash them in." I climbed onto the windowsill and out to the fire escape. When I got my window open, I came back for my groceries, but before I could say thanks and goodbye, she started out onto the fire escape after me. "Let's see your place. I've never been there. Before you moved in, the 2 little old Wagner sisters wouldn't even say good morning to me." She crawled through my window behind me and sat on the ledge. "Come on in," I said, putting the groceries on the table. "I don't have any beer, but I can make you a cup of coffee." But she was looking past me, her eyes wide in disbelief. "My God, I've never seen a place as neat as this. Who would dream that a man living by himself could keep a place so orderly?" "I wasn't always that way," I apologized. "It's just since I moved in here. It was neat when I moved in, and I've had the compulsion to keep it that way. It upsets me now if anything is out of place." She got down off the windowsill to explore the apartment. "Hey," she said suddenly, "do you like to dance? You know." She held out her arms and did a complicated step as she hummed a Latin beat. "Tell me you dance and I'll bust." "Only the foxtrot," I said, "and not very good at that." She shrugged. "I'm nuts about dancing, but nobody I ever meet that I like is a good dancer. I've got to get myself all dolled up once in a while and go downtown to the Stardust Ballroom. Most of the guys hanging around down there are kind of creepy, but they can dance."
She sighed as she looked around. Tell you what I don't like about a place so goddamned orderly like this. As an artist, it's the lines that get me. All the straight lines in the walls, on the floors, in the corners that turn into boxes like coffins. The only way I can get rid of the boxes is to take a few drinks. Then all the lines get wavy and wiggly, and I feel a lot better about the whole world. When things are all straight and lined up this way, I get morbid. Ugh, if I lived here, I'd have to stay drunk all the time. Suddenly, she swung around and faced me. Say, could you let me have 5 until the 20th? That's when my alimony check comes. I usually don't run short, but I had a problem last week. Before I could answer, she screeched and started over to the piano in the corner. I used to play the piano. I heard you fooling around with it a few times, and I said to myself, that guy's goddamned good. That's how I know I wanted to meet you, even before I saw you. I haven't played in such a goddamn long time. She was picking away at the piano as I went into the kitchen to make coffee. You're welcome to practice on it any time, I said. I don't know why I suddenly became so free with my place, but there was something about her that demanded complete unselfishness. I don't leave the front door open yet, but the window isn't locked. And if I'm not here, all you've got to do is climb in through the fire escape. Cream and sugar in your coffee? When she didn't answer, I looked back into the living room. She wasn't there, and as I started toward the window, I heard her voice from Algernon's room. Hey, what's this? She was examining the 3-dimensional plastic maze I had built. She studied it, and then let out another squeal. Modern sculpture, all boxes and straight lines. It's a special maze, I explained, a complex learning device for Algernon. But she was circling around it, excited. They'll go mad for it at the Museum of Modern Art. It's not sculpture, I insisted. I opened the door to Algernon's living cage, attached to the maze, and led him into the maze opening. My God, she whispered. Sculpture with a living element. Charlie, it's the greatest thing since junkmobiles in Tincania. I tried to explain, but she insisted that the living element would make sculpture history. Only when I saw the laughter in her wild eyes did I realize she was teasing me. It could be self-perpetuating art, she went on. A creative experience for the art lover. You get another mouse, and when they have babies, you always keep one to reproduce the living element. Your work of art attains immortality, and all the fashionable people buy copies for conversation pieces. What are you going to call it? All right, I sighed. I surrender. No, she snorted, tapping the plastic dome where Algernon had found his way into the goal box. I surrender is too much of a cliché. How about life is just a box of mazes? You're a nut, I said. Naturally. She spun around and curtsied. I was wondering when you'd notice. About then the coffee boiled over. Halfway through the cup of coffee, she gasped and said she had to run because she had a date a half hour earlier with someone she met at an art exhibit. You wanted some money, I said. She reached into my half-open wallet and pulled out a $5 bill. Till next week, she said, when the check comes. Thanks a mil. She crumpled the money, blew Algernon a kiss, and before I could say anything, she was out the window onto the fire escape and out of sight. I stood there, foolishly looking after her. So damned attractive. So full of life and excitement. Her voice, her eyes, everything about her was an invitation. And she lived out the window and just a fire escape away. June 20th. Perhaps I should have waited before going to see Matt, or not gone to see him at all, I don't know. Nothing turns out the way I expect it to. With the clue that Matt had opened a barber shop somewhere in the Bronx, it was a simple matter to find him. I remembered he had sold for a barber supply company in New York. That led me to Metro Barbershop Supplies, who had a barbershop account under the name of Gordon's Barbershop on Wentworth Street in the Bronx. Matt had often talked about a barbershop of his own. How he hated selling. What battles they had about it.
Rose screaming that a salesman was at least a dignified occupation, but she would never have a barber for a husband. And oh, wouldn't Margaret Finney snicker at the barber's wife? And what about Lois Minor, whose husband was a claims examiner for the alarm casualty company? Wouldn't she stick her nose up in the air? During the years he worked as a salesman, hating every day of it, especially after he saw the movie version of Death of a Salesman, Matt dreamed that he would someday become his own boss. That must have been in his mind in those days when he talked about saving money and gave me my haircuts down in the basement. They were good haircuts, too, he boasted, a lot better than I'd get in that cheap barbershop on Scales Avenue. When he walked out on Rose, he walked out on selling, too, and I admired him for that. I was excited at the thought of seeing him. Memories were warm ones. Matt had been willing to take me as I was. Before Norma, the arguments that weren't about money or impressing the neighbors were about me, that I should be let alone instead of being pushed to do what other kids did, and after Norma, that I had a right to a life of my own even though I wasn't like other children. Always defending me. I couldn't wait to see the expression on his face. He was someone I'd be able to share this with. Wentworth Street was a run-down section of the Bronx. Most of the stores on the street had for rent signs in the windows, and others were closed for the day. But halfway down the block from the bus stop, there was a barber pole reflecting a candy cane of light from the window. The shop was empty except for the barber reading a magazine in the chair nearest the window. When he looked up at me, I recognized Matt. Stocky, red-cheeked, a lot older, and nearly bald with a fringe of gray hair bordering the sides of his head, but still Matt. Seeing me at the door, he tossed the magazine aside. "No waiting you next." I hesitated, and he misunderstood. "Usually not open at this hour, mister. Had an appointment with one of my regulars, but he didn't show. Just about to close. Lucky for you, I sat down to rest my feet. Best haircut and shave in the Bronx." As I let myself be drawn into the shop, he bustled around, pulling out scissors and combs and a fresh neckcloth. "Everything's sanitary, as you can see, which is more than I can say for most barbershops in this neighborhood. Haircut and a shave?" I eased myself into the chair. Incredible that he didn't recognize me when I knew him so plainly. I had to remind myself that he hadn't seen me in more than 15 years, and that my appearance had changed even more in the past months. He studied me in the mirror, now that he had me covered with the striped neckcloth, and I saw a frown of faint recognition. "The works," I said, nodding at the union shop price list. "Haircut, shave, shampoo, suntan." His eyebrows went up. "I've got to meet someone I haven't seen in a long time," I assured him, "and I want to look my best." It was a frightening sensation, having him cut my hair again. Later, as he stropped the razor against leather, the harsh whisper made me cringe. I bent my head under the gentle press of his hand and felt the blade scrape carefully across my neck. I closed my eyes and waited. It was as if I were on the operating table again. My neck muscle knotted, and without warning, it twitched. The blade nicked me just above the Adam's apple. "Hey!" he shouted. "Jesus, take it easy. You moved. Hey, I'm awful sorry." He dashed to wet a towel at the sink. In the mirror, I watched the bright red bubble and the thin line dripping down my throat. Excited and apologizing, he got to it before it reached the neckcloth. Watching him move, adroit for such a short, heavy man, I felt guilty at the deception. I wanted to tell him who I was and have him put his arm around my shoulder so we could talk about the old days, but I waited while he dabbed at the cut with styptic powder. He finished shaving me silently, and then brought the suntan lamp over to the chair and put cool white pads of cotton soaked in witch hazel over my eyes. There, in the bright red inner darkness, I saw what happened the night he took me away from the house for the last time. Charlie is asleep in the other room, but he wakens to the sound of his mother shrieking. He has learned to sleep through quarrels. They are an everyday occurrence in his house. But tonight, there is something terribly wrong in that hysteria. He shrinks back into the pillow and listens.
I can't help it. He's got to go. We've got her to think about. I won't have her come home from school crying every day like this because the children tease her. We can't destroy her chance for a normal life because of him.
What do you want to do? Turn him out into the street?
Put him away. Send him to the Warren State Home.
Let's talk it over in the morning.
No. All you do is talk, and you don't do anything. I don't want him here another day. Now, tonight.
Don't be foolish, Rose. It's too late to do anything tonight.
You're shouting so loud everyone will hear you. I don't care. He goes out tonight. I can't stand looking at him anymore.
You're being impossible, Rose. What are you doing?
I warn you. Get him out of here.
Put that knife down.
I'm not going to have her life destroyed.
You're crazy. Put that knife away.
He's better off dead. He'll never be able to live a normal life. He'll be better off...
You're out of your mind. For God's sake, control yourself.
Then take him away from here. Now. Tonight.
All right. I'll take him over to Herman tonight, and maybe tomorrow we'll find out about getting him into the Warren State Home. There is silence. From the darkness, I feel the shudder pass over the house, and then Matt's voice, less panicky than hers. I know what you've gone through with him, and I can't blame you for being afraid, but you've got to control yourself. I'll take him over to Herman. Will that satisfy you?
That's all I ask. Your daughter is entitled to a life, too.
Matt comes into Charlie's room and dresses his son, and though the boy doesn't understand what is happening, he's afraid. As they go out the door, she looks away. Perhaps she's trying to convince herself that he's already gone out of her life, that he no longer exists. On the way out, Charlie sees on the kitchen table the long carving knife she cuts roasts with, and he senses vaguely that she wanted to hurt him. She wanted to take something away from him and give it to Norma. When he looks back at her, she has picked up a rag to wash the kitchen sink. When the haircut, shave, sun treatment, and the rest were over, I sat in the chair limply, feeling light and slick and clean, and Matt whisked the neckcloth off and offered me a second mirror to see the reflection of the back of my head. Seeing myself in the front mirror, looking into the back mirror as he held it for me, it tilted for an instant into the one angle that produced the illusion of depth. Endless corridors of myself, looking at myself, looking at myself, looking at myself, looking... Which one? Who was I? I thought of not telling him. What good was it for him to know? Just go away and not reveal who I was. Then I remembered that I wanted him to know. He had to admit that I was alive, that I was someone. I wanted him to boast about me to the customers tomorrow as he gave haircuts and shaves. That would make it all real. If he knew I was his son, then I would be a person. Now that you've got the hair off my face... Maybe you'll know me, I said as I stood up, waiting for a sign of recognition. He frowned. What is this, a gag? I assured him it was not a gag, and if he looked and thought hard enough, he'd know me. He shrugged and turned to put his combs and scissors away. I got no time for guessing games. Gotta close up, that'll be $3.50. What if he didn't remember me? What if this was only an absurd fantasy? His hand was out for the money, but I made no move toward my wallet. He had to remember me. He had to know me. But no, of course not.
and as I felt the sour taste in my mouth and the sweat in my palms, I knew that in a minute I would be sick. But I didn't want that in front of him.
Hey, you all right?
Yes, just... wait. I stumbled into one of the chrome chairs and bent forward, gasping for breath, waiting for the blood to come back to my head. My stomach was churning. Oh, God, don't let me faint now. Don't let me look ridiculous in front of him. Water. Some water, please. Not so much for the drink as to make him turn away. I didn't want him to see me like this after all these years. By the time he returned with a glass, I felt a little better.
Here, drink this. Rest a minute, you'll be okay.
He stared at me as I sipped the cool water, and I could see him struggling with half-forgotten memories.
Do I really know you from somewhere?
No. I'm okay. I'll leave in a minute. How could I tell him? What was I supposed to say? Here, look at me. I'm Charlie, the son you wrote off the books. Not that I blame you for it, but here I am, all fixed up better than ever. Test me. Ask me questions. I speak 20 languages, living and dead. I'm a mathematical whiz, and I'm writing a piano concerto that will make them remember me long after I'm gone. How could I tell him? How absurd I was, sitting in his shop, waiting for him to pat me on the head and say, "Good boy." I wanted his approval. The old glow of satisfaction that came to his face when I learned to tie my own shoelaces and button my sweater. I had come here for that look in his face, but I knew I wouldn't get it.
You want me to call a doctor?
I wasn't his son. That was another Charlie. Intelligence and knowledge had changed me, and he would resent me as the others from the bakery resented me, because my growth diminished him. I didn't want that.
I'm okay, I said. Sorry to be a nuisance. I got up and tested my legs.
Something I ate. I'll let you close up now.
As I headed towards the door, his voice called after me sharply. Hey, wait a minute.
His eyes met mine with suspicion.
What are you trying to pull?
I don't understand. His hand was out, rubbing his thumb and forefinger together.
You owe me $350.
I apologized as I paid him, but I could see that he didn't believe it. I gave him $5, told him to keep the change, and hurried out of his barber shop without looking back. June 21st. I've added time sequences of increasing complexity to the three-dimensional maze, and Algernon learns them easily. There is no need to motivate him with food or water. He appears to learn for the sake of solving the problem. Success appears to be its own reward. But, as Bert pointed out at the convention, his behavior is erratic. Sometimes after or even during a run, he will rage, throw himself against the walls of the maze, or curl up and refuse to work at all. Frustration? Or something deeper? 5:30 p.m. That crazy Fay came in through the fire escape this afternoon with a female white mouse, about half Algernon's size, to keep him company, she said, on these lonely summer nights. She quickly overcame all my objections and convinced me that it would do Algernon good to have companionship. After I assured myself that little Minnie was of sound health and good moral character, I agreed. I was curious to see what he would do when confronted with a female. But once we had put Minnie into Algernon's cage, Faye grabbed my arm and pulled me out of the room.
"Where's your sense of romance?" she insisted.
She turned on the radio and advanced toward me menacingly. "I'm going to teach you the latest steps." How can you get annoyed at a girl like Fay? At any rate, I'm glad that Algernon is no longer alone. June 23rd.
Late last night, the sound of laughter in the hallway and a tapping on my door. It was Faye and a man.
"Hi, Charlie," she giggled as she saw me. "Leroy, meet Charlie. He's my across-the-hall neighbor, a wonderful artist. He does sculpture with a living element."
Leroy caught hold of her and kept her from bumping into the wall. He looked at me nervously and mumbled a greeting.
"Met Leroy at the Stardust Ballroom," she explained. "He's a terrific dancer."
She started into her apartment and then pulled him back.
"Hey," she giggled. "Why don't we invite Charlie over for a drink and make it a party?"
Leroy didn't think it was a good idea. I managed an apology and pulled away. Behind my closed door, I heard them laughing their way into her apartment, and though I tried to read, the pictures kept forcing their way into my mind. A big white bed, white, cool sheets, and the two of them in each other's arms. I wanted to phone Alice, but I didn't. Why torment myself? I couldn't even visualize Alice's face. I could picture Faye, dressed or undressed, at will, with her crisp blue eyes and her blonde hair braided and coiled around her head like a crown. Faye was clear, but Alice was wrapped in mist. About an hour later, I heard shouting from Faye's apartment. Then her scream and the sound of things being thrown. But as I started out of bed to see if she needed help, I heard the door slam, Leroy cursing as he left. Then, a few minutes afterward, I heard a tapping on my living room window. It was open, and Faye slipped in and sat on the ledge, a black silk kimono revealing lovely legs.
"Hi," she whispered. "Got a cigarette?"
I handed her one, and she slipped down from the window ledge to the couch. "Phew," she sighed.
"I can usually take care of myself, but there's one type that's so hungry it's all you can do to hold them off."
"Oh," I said, "you brought him up here to hold him off?" She caught my tone and looked up sharply. "You don't approve?" "Who am I to disapprove? But if you pick up a guy in a public dance hall, you've got to expect advances. He had the right to make a pass at you." She shook her head.
"I go to the Stardust Ballroom because I like to dance. And I don't see that because I let a guy bring me home, I've got to go to bed with him. You don't think I went to bed with him, do you?"
My image of the two of them in each other's arms popped like soap bubbles.
"Now if you were the guy," she said, "it would be different."
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"Just what it sounds like. If you asked me, I'd go to bed with you."
I tried to keep my composure.
"Thanks," I said. "I'll keep that in mind. Can I get you a cup of coffee?" "Charlie, I can't figure you out. Most men like me or not, and I know it right away, but you seem afraid of me.
You're not a homosexual, are you?"
"Hell no. I mean, you don't have to hide it from me if you are, because then we could be just good friends. But I'd have to know."
"I'm not a homosexual. Tonight, when you went into your place with that guy, I wished it was me." She leaned forward, and the kimono, open at the neck, revealed her bosom. She slipped her arms around me, waiting for me to do something. I knew what was expected of me, and I told myself there was no reason not to.
I had the feeling there would be no panic now, not with her. After all, I wasn't the one making the advances, and she was different from any woman I'd ever met before. Perhaps she was right for me at this emotional level. I slipped my arms around her.
"That's different," she cooed.
"I was beginning to think you didn't care."
"I care," I whispered, kissing her throat. But as I did it, I saw the two of us, as if I were a third person standing in the doorway. I was watching a man and woman in each other's arms, but seeing myself that way from a distance left me unresponsive. There was no panic, it was true,
But there was also no excitement, no desire.
"Your place or mine?" she asked.
"Wait a minute.
What's the matter?"
"Maybe we'd better not. I don't feel well this evening."
She looked at me wonderingly.
"Is there anything else, anything you want me to do? I don't mind."
"No, that's not it," I said sharply. "I just don't feel well tonight." I was curious about the ways she had of getting a man excited, but this was no time to start experimenting. The solution to my problem lay elsewhere. I didn't know what else to say to her. I wished she'd go away, but I didn't want to tell her to go. She was studying me. And then finally she said,
"Look, do you mind if I spend the night here?"
"Why?" She shrugged. "I like you. I don't know. Leroy might come back. Lots of reasons. If you don't want me to..." She caught me off guard again. I might have found a dozen excuses to get rid of her, but I gave in.
"Got any gin?"
she asked. "No, I don't drink much."
"I've got some in my place. I'll bring it over."
Before I could stop her, she was out the window, and a few minutes later she returned with a bottle about two-thirds full and a lemon. She took two glasses from my kitchen and poured some gin into each.
"Here," she said. "This'll make you feel better. It'll take the starch out of those straight lines. That's what's bugging you. Everything is too neat and straight, and you're all boxed in like Algernon in his sculpture there." I wasn't going to at first, but I felt so lousy that I figured, why not? It couldn't make things any worse, and it might possibly dull the feeling that I was watching myself through eyes that didn't understand what I was doing. She got me drunk. I remember the first drink, and getting into bed, and her slipping in beside me with the bottle in her hand. And that was all, until this afternoon when I got up with a hangover. She was still asleep, face to the wall, her pillow bunched up under her neck. On the night table, beside the ashtray overflowing with crushed butts, stood the empty bottle. But the last thing I remembered before the curtain came down was watching myself take the second drink. She stretched and rolled toward me, nude. I moved back and fell out of bed. I grabbed a blanket to wrap around myself. "Hi," she yawned. "You know what I want to do one of these days?"
"What?"
"Paint you in the nude, like Michelangelo's David. You'd be beautiful. You okay?"
I nodded. Except for a headache.
"Did I, drink too much last night?"
She laughed and propped herself up on one elbow.
"You were loaded! And boy, did you act queer. I don't mean fairyish or anything like that, but strange."
"What," I said, struggling to work the blanket around so that I could walk, "is that supposed to mean? What did I do?"
"I've seen guys get happy, or sad, or sleepy, or sexy, but I never saw anyone act the way you did. It's a good thing you don't drink often. Oh, my God, I only wish I had a camera. What a short subject you'd have made."
"Well, for Christ's sake, what'd I do?"
"Not what I expected. No sex or anything like that. But you were phenomenal. What an act, the weirdest. You'd be great on the stage. You'd wow them at the palace. You went all confused and silly. You know, as if a grown man starts acting like a kid, talking about how you wanted to go to school and learn to read and write so you could be smart like everyone else. Crazy stuff like that. You were a different person, like they do with method acting. And you kept saying you couldn't play with me because your mother would take away your peanuts and put you in a cage."
"Peanuts?"
"Yeah, so help me," she laughed, scratching her head. "And you kept saying I couldn't have your peanuts. The weirdest. But I tell you, the way you talked, like those dimwits on street corners who work themselves up by just looking at a girl. A different guy completely. At first I thought you were just kidding around, but now I think you're compulsive or something. All this neatness and worrying about everything." It didn't upset me, although I would have expected it to. Somehow,
Getting drunk had momentarily broken down the conscious barriers that kept the old Charlie Gordon hidden deep in my mind. As I suspected all along, he wasn't really gone. Nothing in our minds is ever really gone. The operation had covered him over with a veneer of education and culture, but emotionally, he was there, watching and waiting. What was he waiting for?
You okay now?
I told her I was fine. She grabbed the blanket I was wrapped in and pulled me back into bed. Before I could stop her, she slipped her arms around me and kissed me.
I was scared last night, Charlie. I thought you flipped. I heard about guys who were impotent, how it suddenly gets them and they become maniacs.
How come you stayed? She shrugged.
Well, you were like a scared little kid. I was sure you wouldn't hurt me, but I thought you might hurt yourself. So I figured I'd hang around. I felt so sorry. Anyway, I kept this handy just in case.
She pulled out a heavy bookend she had wedged between the bed and the wall. I guess you didn't have to use it. She shook her head.
Boy, you must have liked peanuts when you were a kid.
She got out of bed and started to dress. I lay there for a while, watching her. She moved in front of me with no shyness or inhibition. Her breasts were full as she had painted them in that self-portrait. I longed to reach out for her, but I knew it was futile. In spite of the operation, Charlie was still with me. And Charlie was afraid of losing his peanuts.
This ends Disc 5.